Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. I'm Diana Isaacs, and I'm here with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have another very exciting episode for you all. There has just been so much happening with the ISPAD conference, EASD, Obesity Week. So it's been a lot, really, really exciting. And what we wanted to focus on in this episode is actually a very recent report out of the PROTECT study with teplizumab, or TZIELD is the brand name. So we've talked about this before. We talked about the TN10 study was this big study that got it basically led to the approval, where now it's FDA approved for stage 2 type 1 diabetes to delay the progression to stage 3 type 1 diabetes. But this study was really different because it studied it in people that have full-blown type 1 diabetes, stage 3 type 1 diabetes, to see if it could preserve their beta cells and kind of how it affected their insulin levels and A1Cs and all that other stuff. So before I keep going on and on and on, Natalie, can you share a little bit about kind of what was the structure of this trial and everything?
Absolutely. So it was a phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trial. What does that mean? That means a group got the drug, a group got a placebo infusion. No one knew who was going to get what. And they looked at beta cell preservation, clinical endpoints, and then safety, who with the people that received the teplizumab or placebo for 2 separate 12-day courses. So these are people already diagnosed with type 1. They're taking insulin. They are working like the rest of the people with type 1 out. And they got early in that first few weeks of diagnosis. They pulled these people and said, let's see if we can use teplizumab to do what? To preserve that beta cell function. And when we talked to people about this in the beginning, what does that preservation look like? Well, that's what we call the honeymoon, right? When someone gets diagnosed, their glucoses tend to be very high. We give them some insulin. And when I teach it, I actually say, the pancreatic cells almost go, oh, okay, you can have a little bit more. With teplizumab, though, the group that got that drug, they looked at C-peptide levels at week 78, so way far out after delivering the drug, and those people had a higher C-peptide. C-peptide is the residual of endogenous insulin production. Endogenous insulin is the insulin that your body makes. We can measure the difference. So we know if it's insulin that was given from a syringe or a pump versus insulin made in the body. And that residual is C-peptide. We can measure that. So those people had more C-peptide, and that means they have more beta cell preservation. So there were some other key endpoints, though. And they looked at A1 hemoglobin levels, time in target glucose, and some hypoglycemic events. They didn't meet the secondary endpoints. The challenge with this study is that there weren't enough people to meet the secondary endpoints. So we can't decide, although they looked favorable. So we can't say, oh, it doesn't work in doing other things. But at this point, what we can say is it did preserve beta cell function, and it was significant. Adverse events. We got to talk about adverse events, right? We're giving a CD3 monoclonal antibody, right? You get headache, GI symptoms, rash. We get some lymphopenia. In the first studies, about 75% of people get lymphopenia. And then mild but not severe cytokine release syndrome, which kind of presents like a little bit of flu-like symptoms. This is very exciting. They announced it at ISPAD, the International Pediatric Diabetes Society meeting, and it was at the same time published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is very exciting. We've never been able to preserve beta cell function in people with type 1. We've never been able to have a drug that would do something like this. So it's not indicated for this yet, but this is the first step in gaining that indication.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because the way that the drug was delivered is a little bit different than how it's delivered in terms of right now, its current indication. So it was actually a 12-day infusion that was given twice. So versus its current 14-day infusion. So that's a little bit different. But it's just, yeah, I'm really curious to see kind of what happens. And I hope that they look beyond. I mean, 78 weeks is a long time. So it's great that it was continued for that long, but I hope that they follow these patients even longer, because I know I'm really curious, like, what is this? Is this maybe, it, will it have an effect 2 years later, 3 years later, 4 years later, where still maybe insulin doses would be lower? And even though in its current study, they didn't see differences in A1C, maybe in the future, there could be those greater differences if one group has that greater preservation of their beta cells. So,
right. And there's so many other discussions that then come out of this, right? What happens if we give a third? Can I continue to preserve beta cell function forever? I mean, can I, you know, do I need a third infusion every other year, every year? How do we continue to push those, you know, that immune response away? So are there more? And again, they had to stop. They stopped at 78 weeks. If you look at the first teplizumab studies, when they got the drug approved for that stage 2 type 1 diabetes, which is two positive antibodies and dysglycemia, slightly high fastings, high but not at all the way towards diabetes post-meal, a slightly elevated A1C, but still less than 6.5, those dysglycemic people, they stopped the study to publish and read out. There are still people in that original study that have not developed type 1 diabetes yet. So they're continuing to follow those in the follow-up studies. I am assuming that they're going to continue to do the same thing here. And that's where we start to get to, so these people, we've preserved their C-peptide. Now what? What if I add, and you and I talked about this on a previous podcast, we looked at some people with early onset type 1 that we used semaglutide. They used semaglutide with, and that preserved beta cell function. We've looked at the use of verapamil that also preserves beta cell function. And this is where we can look at precision medicine now. Can I use a little bit of something after their infusion? Can we, and you know, pick and choose? And we don't know yet. We don't know the answers. But this is really exciting, especially for those newly diagnosed.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that, like, even though A1C was similar, time in range, a higher percentage of people did reach each time in range target when they looked at how many, what percentage were over 80% in range or 70% or 60%. There were definitely higher amounts in the teplizumab group. So sometimes these studies, while they don't show improvements in all the outcomes, there's still a favorable enough effect that I am secretly hoping that this is enough to gain an additional indication from the FDA, because I want to throw everything at the person to see that we can just give them the best outcomes as possible. And one of the things we know is that when someone is diagnosed abruptly, like they're diagnosed in DKA, or they don't have, their management is not as good their first year, I shouldn't say good, but their management isn't at goal the first year, that their long-term outcomes can be worse compared to someone who is meeting all of their goals initially after diagnosis. So to me, that would translate to, if you've got a drug that can preserve beta cells, that ideally you can get this, you can screen someone and you can give this stage 2. And so they don't get diagnosed in DKA, but even if they do, you can give this initially and really help them those first couple years after their diagnosis. That would set them up for long-term success. So I would just love to see a new FDA-approved indication for this.
Right. And remember, you know, what you're talking about for our listeners or in our audience is that metabolic memory. That first few years seems to have a very big impact on the long-term outcomes. So if I can reduce the risk, I mean, when people walk into my exam rooms, I say, my job is to help you protect your organs, right? Because that's what diabetes does. It damages organs in the end. This is such a possibility for us to truly make a difference in people's lives. I'm very excited. I really am. And again, this is only study data at this point. It's not FDA approved for this new indication. So it'll be exciting to see what happens in the next handful of months, because it will take months to get approval. I mean, months to another year or two even. So let's see how this looks and how quickly they can bring this to the FDA. Is it enough people? Is it powered strongly enough? There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of ifs in all of it, but the initial data is exciting.
Right. Yeah, that's true. They may need to possibly do some more studies or follow these people a little bit longer. Unfortunately, this is an area where I don't think we're going to develop real-world data. So sometimes we know clinicians can always prescribe things off-label. And then in doing that, sometimes we develop real-world data, like, for example, with the use of semaglutide, where we've got some of that data in type 1 diabetes and that study that or that editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine, where we saw the positive impact of those patients given that a diagnosis. But with this drug, it is quite expensive. And so the whole process of obtaining it, it's not going to be the kind of thing you could just be like, oh, you want to try it? Here you go. It really will require insurance approval,
right,
and therefore a label.
There are no samples in our office. There are no, right? Yeah. There are no, here, try this. Let's see how you, yeah, there's none of that. You're right.
Right. In the expense of the infection, right, and everything. So.
Which can be painful for the people who have a child or an adult in their life that got diagnosed today. You know, I mean, but there are continuing ongoing studies. So, you know, the best way to look for type 1 research is honestly, I send people to the JDRF website, and you can actually, they have a lovely search engine there where you can put in, what do you have? Type 1, how long have you had it? You know, and you answer a handful of questions, how far are you willing to travel? And all the available type 1 studies will come up for that person with diabetes. You can be the parent, you can be the child, you can be the patient, and you can look at different studies that are available. So if people are interested, that's a great, as a clinician, I send people there all the time because sometimes the studies are in our backyard and we don't realize it.
Yeah, that's a really good point to check for studies for sure. And then also just, I want to encourage everyone to consider getting screened for those type 1 diabetes autoantibodies, because at this point we do, teplizumab is FDA approved for that stage 2 type 1 diabetes. So if you're screened and you know you have those autoantibodies, you can keep a watchful eye on those glucose levels. And when it reaches stage 2, then the person is eligible for that infusion. And likely, I would think catching it at that point could really have the long-term implications, and not just delaying to type 1, but hopefully even experiencing a slower type 1 progression once that develops. So,
and I think that's a really great point to close on. The ADA's guidelines, the American Diabetes Association guidelines, which, you know, I bring the journal when it comes to my house. I mean, it's a celebration. Diana and I are like, look what we got, right? The guidelines say we should be offering screenings to first degree relatives of people with type 1. And I challenge people on this. It's to say, are you doing that? If you have someone that sees you for type 1 diabetes, are you offering screening for first degree relatives? So if you have an adult with type 1, their children, their siblings, and their parents. And we really need to strategize as communities of clinicians to help people. I just need them to screen. If they're positive, you can call my office. I'll get that person in a week. You know, we will make room for people with 2 positive autoantibodies. We'll do the glucose screening if you want us to. We will help you. 2 positive autoantibodies means you have almost 100% chance of getting type 1 in your lifetime. We need those people. And they're considered type 1, even if their glucoses are still normal. They go out and they have a banana split and they check their sugar. They're making plenty of insulin still, but we know what's happening in the background. So as clinicians, I think we all should be making a better effort at saying, I need to be offering screening to everyone, even if it's just, here's the handout, consider this, we can talk about it at the next visit, and you stage it over several visits.
Yeah, and I just would encourage people, you can learn more about screening like on the JDRF website. Enable Biosciences has low-cost testing options. There's also TrialNet for those that do have family members that are eligible for free screening as well. And then the other plug I would just give is, a lot of people get diagnosed and they don't have family members. So the other high risk factor is also if you have other autoimmune conditions like celiac disease, like Hashimoto's. And so those would also be great candidates to get screened as well.
Yeah. Exciting stuff. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is. I just love having a new agent and seeing potential new uses for it and just making a difference. And so with that, thanks so much, everyone, for tuning into this episode. We will definitely be back in the very near future with more. So wishing you all the best.